Welcome to another edition of Loveline. The title of tonight's show is Safe Sex. Are people doing it anymore? I'm your host, DJ Safe Sex 10,000, and I have two very special guests with me in the studio tonight. Sebastian, master of the bathhouse, who was here in a previous edition of Loveline as a guest and is returning as a sexual bathhouse expert. And Bill. Bill is from the Pitt Men's Study, and Bill is an expert on many things, Pittsburgh men studying, all of those things. So thank you all for listening, and we look forward to a great show before us today. Bill, welcome.
Well, thanks. Good to be here.
And let me start out by asking, what is this Pitt Men's Study you speak of?
The Pitt Men's Study is a study that's been going on since 1984 and has roots a couple years before that. I've enrolled over 3,000 gay and bisexual men in this area and surrounding areas to try to understand the natural history of HIV infection And we're still going on trying to, try to get this thing figured out.
So, Bill, what's involved if I was a member of this Pittman study?
It would depend if you're like in the national cohort, as we call it. There's two groups, and the national cohort involves about an hour long to sometimes 2 hour long visit. There's blood draw, physical exam, questionnaires, all this kind of stuff. The other study is a screening study, which is a very short questionnaire that you fill out at home and drop off, and all you get is one tube drawn for an HIV test. But you come in every 6 months, mm-hmm. regardless.
Mm-hmm. And so this study's been going for a lot. What can I just ask? What have we learned, and what do we know about HIV and men today?
I'm not sure I know how to answer that. We've learned so much. What particular thing do you want to know about?
Well, So, you've heard a lot in the news lately about these drug cocktails that are extending people's lives and doing a lot to combat the disease. I might understand that the men's study is more of a behavioral study, like.
No. Well, we do look at things like that. It started up, I think, first of all, as an epidemiological study to kind of figure out who is getting infected and how they were getting infected and patterns of infection in different areas. It also has a very strong microbiological component where we actually look at the immune system. And we do an awful lot of work trying to figure out different white blood cells and what they do and how the virus acts and how you combat it. And so there's a lot of different things. There's socioeconomic parts of the studies, neuropsychiatric parts of the study. There's a lot.
So given that it's, and I believe we were talking about this earlier, given that it's this late in this epidemic, you know, entering what, the 20th year?
It's at least 17.
Why are people continuing to get infected? You know, why haven't people, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Do we understand pretty well how people get AIDS?
Right.
We understand the behaviors. I guess anal sex is unprotected. Anal receptive anal intercourse is the number one.
Is the number one.
And is it true that people are still doing that? And is that how most people are still, new infections are still getting AIDS?
Unfortunately, people are still doing that. And yes, that is exactly how people are getting it, at least in the gay and bisexual community.
Well, Bill, could you maybe say a few words about the recent changes in the spread of the AIDS virus as compared to how it was spreading maybe 10 years ago? Have you seen a change in the way it's been spreading lately?
Well, there are statistics that show that the rate of infection in gay men may be down. It doesn't mean that the numbers are any less horrifying. I mean, you hear too about this explosion of infection among straight people, and it kind of comes down to a statistics game, and that is that if there are some if you have like 300 people get infected 1 year and 600 people get infected the next year, that's a 100% increase,
mm-hmm,
or whatever, right? And if you talk about 50,000 people got infected last year and another 10,000 got infected the next year, that's a 20% increase.
Mm-hmm.
That's still 10,000 people versus 300. So that, I still think that there is a lot of infection going on between gay and bisexual men. It's still a very serious problem. Not to poo-poo what's going on in the straight community, because it is becoming more problematic for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think that that leads us right back to the topic of this episode, safe sex. Are people doing it anymore?
I would say that most of the people who I talk to are being pretty darn safe, but there's a substantial minority of people out there that are not being safe for a variety of different reasons. I'd say if you look at young people, I think there's a lot of young people who out there who think that if they only have sex with other young people, they'll be safe, because young people, why should they be infected? It's the old people that are infected.
Mm-hmm.
If I stick with people my age that are young, how can they be infected if they're just having sex with other young people just coming out?
So you've actually heard youngsters come into your study and say, you know, my defense against this virus is to have sex with people who are 25 and under.
Or even younger than that, 22 and under.
And they really believe that?
Yeah. And yet I can show you people who I've tested at the age of 18, and they've already been infected, and they already have serious impairment of their immune system. That means they've been infected sometime when they were teenagers.
And is it not true that age group is one of the fastest growing?
Oh, yeah. And the statistic we have that's kind of disturbing is in this area, metropolitan Pittsburgh, 1 in 13 gay and bisexual youth under the age of 22 that we have tested have been positive at their first appointment. 1 in 13. It was just pretty substantial when you figure that how long have they really been out.
Mm-hmm. Right. Can we extend that to the general population, or are people that join your study, are they more likely to be positive than the average population? I mean, what does it say about the youth in Pittsburgh?
I think it pretty much reflects what's going on out there. I think one of the things that has been very interesting in working in the study is just what a microcosm it is of the community when you look at the demographics and the behaviors and things like that. I really think that it reflects in a microcosm what is going on out there.
I'd like to interrupt for a second. We have a new host. Our friend Art has joined us in the studio. The rest of our normal hosts are on assignment in various parts of the Western Pennsylvania. Art, say hello to our listeners.
Hello. Yeah, I was just with Pablo. He's still stuck, but he sent me along, and things should go well.
Great. And by the way, if you have questions for our esteemed panel, please call us at 268-WRCT or 621-WRCT. Don't forget to check the website also, http://loveline.wrct.com. So, Sebastian.
Yes.
Let me ask you a question from the more practical perspective, since you are a connoisseur of bathhouses the world over.
A connoisseur, that's right.
What are you seeing out there in the field?
In the field.
That's cruise zone beta, Corey.
Well, as you know, I do frequent the bathhouses every once in a while, and it's not uncommon to see anal intercourse unprotected going on.
Seriously?
Oh, yes.
Presumably between strangers or
well, that's usually
intimate
the,
strangers.
The idea behind going to a bathhouse that maybe you don't even exchange first names, if that. Certainly a lot of oral sex. I think that most gay men have reverted to oral sex as the safe alternative to anal sex.
And so what is the safety risk of oral sex? Oral sex with presumably without ejaculation is safer than the alternative.
Well, presumably.
So, I mean, where can we place this on a scale of safety? Is there
some sort of quantifiable way that we can compare these things, or?
It's very hard to separate the oral component from anal in doing the epidemiology, but when we teach people about safe sex, when we enroll people in the study, they have to go through an hour and a half long educational session that talks about all kinds of different aspects of the epidemic. And what we would tell them to do is to imagine a group of 100 gay men, gay or bisexual men, who were HIV positive, that about 98% of those people were infected because of receptive anal intercourse without a condom. Mm-hmm. And maybe one of those people, it was because they had been the penetrating partner in anal intercourse, not using a condom. And that would leave one person who might well have been infected through an oral route.
But with these, it's sort of hard to separate everything because many of those 98 also did the other activities.
Yeah, it's hard to separate. People just don't do one. If people just stuck to one sex act for maybe 6 months or a year, then we could maybe pinpoint this. But people are much more fun than that. So,
Bill, can we talk about the oral risk for a moment?
Sure.
Now, if I have good oral hygiene and my gums are fine and I don't let the person ejaculate in my mouth, is there really a risk?
There is always a risk because you are allowing somebody's body fluids, and we're talking about pre-ejaculate in this case, to get into an orifice of your body. So there's going to be virus in your mouth, and it could find a way in. Even with good oral hygiene, there's a possibility. It becomes very small, but it's still a possibility. I can't say it's safe. 100% safe. I have to say there is a risk for infection, but it certainly beats if you had knew you had some sort of sore or ulcer in your mouth, or you let someone ejaculate in your mouth. We're now escalating the risk factor.
Right. But it's important to be relative about this. Like, what's the risk of, say, performing oral sex on somebody with no mouth sores, no ejaculate, compared to, say, you know, flying value jet, right? Or taking the bus to school. I mean, what are we playing golf in a lightning storm? I mean, where does this fall? Dating Bill Clinton. I mean, you know, what are the
Well, if we can compare it to other sex acts.
I mean, of course, nothing is completely safe, but, you know, we live in...
You can start with abstinence. Abstinence is certainly the safest thing you can do. It's also the most boring thing you can do. You can escalate up from there. With being penetrated anally without a condom is certainly your highest risk, and it's way up in the stratosphere. You start coming down as you get away from that act. But I'm going to be very straightforward and tell everybody out there that I can't tell them it is safe to have oral sex without a condom. I cannot say it's safe. I will not say it's safe. There is a risk. It is small, and it boils down to, when you look at the relative risks, what are you willing to accept as your risk factor? Now, I would say that if someone says, okay, I know my mouth is in good shape, and I know the person I'm with doesn't have a lot of pre-ejaculate and will not come in my mouth, then, you know, that's okay. Fine, go ahead and do that. If you're accepting a certain, you have to accept that there is a risk there, but it is very small. I think that's fine. Where I get into a huff are these people who are still having anal sex without condoms, and I cannot understand it. I theoretically understand on an intellectual basis. On a gut level, I can't understand it, because it just defies the reality of the world out there.
But people are also famous for misapprehending the risk that they're subjecting them to. I mean, anybody that plays the lottery is clearly, for example, overestimating how likely they are to win.
Right, and so they lose a couple of bucks every week. We're not talking about losing, like, you know, a big chunk of your life.
Right.
Completely different.
So the stakes are so much higher, of course.
Absolutely.
In this particular lottery.
Well, it is certainly the case that people are still having anal sex unprotected. I myself have been propositioned to partake in such an activity, which, of course, I declined.
At the bathhouses or in Pittsburgh's cruise zone?
No, not there, but in bathhouses. It just astonished me.
One of the things that I found interesting when I was in San Francisco is that the sex clubs there, particularly one that allows anal intercourse, is very, very, very firm about that. You know, if you do anything that's unprotected anally, you're out of there, and they actually monitor. But that is a rarity, you know, among bathhouses, I think.
I do want to point out that most bathhouses do provide condoms for free,
mm-hmm.
as a courtesy.
Yes.
So there are people that are doing these unsafe behaviors. Do you find that there are people who are, you know, for lack of a better term, falling off the wagon? That is, they're good for a while, you know, they do all the right things for a couple of years, and then they revert to unsafe behavior?
There's a certain amount of recidivism. I know people who have been in the study for about as long as it's been there. We're doing just great, and then something happened that they fell off the wagon. And there are all kinds of reasons. They're psychological, sociological.
Does something really have to happen? Couldn't they just get fed up with it?
Yeah, and that's part of it, too. And that's a psychological thing. They just have had enough, 14 years, of not being able to do, you know, the things that they remember doing back in the so-called good old days.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, in your opinion, is it worse to be an older gay man and remember what you could be doing, what you did in the good old days, or to be a young just person just coming out and, you know, having to deal with this all of a sudden, but not having those memories?
Speaking for myself, I think it would be harder for me if I had not come out in a slightly less risky time. Although, actually, we should have known. Well, I mean, it was risky, we just didn't know it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't speak for everybody, but that's how I feel.
I mean, just how good were the good old days? I mean, are these risky behaviors really so powerfully attractive that a person would not want to do without them? I mean, there's lots of different ways to have an orgasm. I mean, you know,
absolutely.
You know, just watching Star Trek Voyager these days is enough for me. But seriously, I mean, what was so great about the good old days that is? I mean, random nasty sex with large groups of strangers? Is that really there important?
There was a compelling. It wasn't the act so much as I think it was the just the atmosphere of the time. Everything was open. Everybody was having a good time. Everybody was friends. You know, you met somebody, you had sex with them instead of shaking their hand. It was just very open and free and all that kind of stuff.
But you can still do that as long as you're wearing mitts, right?
Yeah, I know. But see, now you're putting some brakes on the whole thing. It's like, you know, you're going along the real well, and all of a sudden, excuse me, I got to put the condom on now. That is different. I mean, I'm not defending that. I'm just saying that is different for people. I don't have a problem with it.
But some people really.
Some people do.
Every time I see this, I just get totally outraged. This whole idea that, oh my gosh, I've interrupted the sexual act by having to put on this condom. I mean, how ridiculous is that?
Well, really, because I mean, that's part of the sexual act is putting on the condom. If you want to look at it that way, I mean, that's part of the whole gig. That's how good. You know what else gets me is a lot of people. And we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about this. Think that condoms won't fit. And I just want to tell the guys out there, get over it. They fit anybody. You don't need the max size. If you need the really, really, really big ones, you're of a very small percentage of the population, and almost anybody I've ever seen, I would say anybody I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot, can fit into the average American condom. I'm sorry. I don't get this it doesn't fit thing.
Nobody really claims that, though.
With a straight face, so to speak, yeah. Mm-hmm. they're all always too tight, they're uncomfortable. That's baloney. The other thing is a sensitivity issue. If you're the person being penetrated, I'm sorry, there is no difference between a penis that is unsheathed and one that is sheathed versus certain other things you can use down there. I mean, there's not that kind of sensation available down there, guys. If you're the person doing the penetrating, I will agree, it feels a little different, but it still feels pretty darn good. And I'm tired of hearing people with this sensitivity issue.
And they're presumably like extra thin.
The condoms today are so thin and they transmit heat and sensation so well. You might as well be wearing nothing. So why not put it on and be safe?
Is there a difference in safety for anal sex with the extra thin condoms? Are you getting substantially more safety if you go for the thick or the extra thick ones that are available?
I'm gonna actually make you think about the question because we have a caller and I'd like to put them on the air. Welcome, caller.
Hi there. Am I on?
You're on.
Great. So I wanted to make an observation about the discussion that's going on, and it's kind of a bug that I find people often have with discussions of safe sex, which is that, I find that a lot of discussions of safe sex are kind of pervaded with a little bit of self-righteousness. You know, oh, of course we should all be having safe sex. Oh, you know, there's just no excuse for not wanting to have safe sex. Whereas I think we should be a little more honest about it and say, you know, there really are aspects of this that are no fun. And if we talked about those openly, the fact that there are parts of it that are just no fun, then maybe we would make more progress in getting people to, actually do it.
Okay, so give me an example of something that's, like, not fun about safe sex.
Okay, so here's a scenario. You just meet this great guy. You go out on a date. You know, you've shared a nice bottle of wine. You look romantically into each other's eyes. And now you want to start fooling around. Well, the last thing you want to be thinking about is the possibility of death. And let's face it, I mean, that's what we're really trying to prevent when we talk about safe sex. So just the very notion of conjuring up the possibility of getting this disease is really unromantic to begin with. And certainly having to broach conversations about previous partners and previous sex acts and all this, you know, this is a really difficult thing when you've just met somebody or even if you've been going out for a while. It's pretty tough.
Well, okay, but I mean, in my opinion, you don't necessarily have to do the whole medical history if you're playing safe anyway, right? I mean,
That's what I always tell people. I say you have to look at it this way. You treat every person you have sex with as if they are HIV positive. You do with them only the things you would do with someone you knew to be HIV positive. And if you start from there, you don't have to discuss anything. It's just natural to go through the safe stuff.
Right, but listen to what you just said. I now have to face this person that I'm really romantically interested in and start thinking about this person as though they're infected with, you know, a rather traumatic disease. I mean, do you see the lack of romance in that?
No, I guess I don't, because I don't have a problem with that.
Okay.
I dated someone who was HIV positive.
Right.
So, you know,
absolutely,
I mean, to me, it's just like, you know.
I certainly don't want to in any way, denigrate people who have HIV. But nonetheless, the point of safe sex is to prevent the spread of the virus. So that's the only sense in which I mean it's unromantic. Sorry, I don't mean to be.
Oh no, I understand. And, you know, and I want to go back to your original point where you were talking about. Let me see, what was it? Some being kind of self-righteous about the whole thing. I guess I'm up on my high horse because I'm not speaking as a member of the Pittman Study. I think I forgot to mention that earlier. As a person who works at the Pittman Study, I mean, the facts I'll give you are stuff we talk about, but the emotional content of what I'm talking about today is me and not the University of Pittsburgh. I have a job where for the last nearly 10 years, I have watched people get infected and die. And I have even very recently watched people who had not been infected for years wind up becoming positive and going through that particular sort of hell that happens to someone when they have been doing really well for years and all of a sudden they fall off the wagon for some reason and they show up positive. And I have to deal with that. And I'm really, I guess what I'm up here getting on my high horse about is, stop it, guys. I'm tired of this. I want you all to be healthy and live. And people have very human excuses, and I understand that. People are in situations where, as you describe, it's a very intimate act, and you don't want to introduce this thing. But the truth of the matter is, sooner or later, if you don't talk about it, and that's part of your point, if you don't talk about it, it's going to keep happening. And it's really rough on everybody.
No, I certainly appreciate that, and I do advocate talking about it. But my point is, if we acknowledge a little bit more that this really is a tough thing, maybe we can collectively come up with strategies that, you know, for talking about this and so on, that doesn't make it feel quite so overwhelming.
Yeah, well, one of the things I think that's been very nice recently is that the Pittman Study, we have a fellow who's a counselor, social worker, who has been doing some group sessions with people who are in the study. People, we let our clientele know about them and they can enroll in them. And they talk about these very issues in a very open forum that's very nurturing and all that. And I think that we need more of that in this town, and I do not have in my clinic the resources to extend that out into the community. I do not have the economic resources, so we've got to find some way, perhaps, of doing that and offering this outside and getting people involved. They do this in other cities.
I'd like to address this point of the sort of disruption of intimacy. I mean, it seems to me like given a choice between being in sort of denial about my partner's possible infectivity status and feeling liberated from that, like, you know, I know for a fact that we're doing these activities that could not possibly infect me, we should both be happier and more aroused by that. I mean, I would think it'd be great, you know, please go ahead, urinate on my unbroken skin, go for it. I mean, I'd be, you know, that's, and I, if I know there's no danger, I don't have to go and play this mind game where I have to suppress my worry. I can actually embrace my worry because I've done the right thing with respect to it. Isn't that not? I mean, am I totally on crack here, or what's?
Well, you know, that does make sense to me. But still, I mean, just the act of bringing it up has, you know, it admits to the danger and the consequences and so on.
Well, you know, my philosophy is that there are a lot of things in life that aren't pleasant, and this is one of them. You know, taxes are not pleasant, but I still pay them, right? I'm sorry. That's just my view on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a totally different reality than it was in 1977. This is a completely different world we live in. And even if I cured AIDS tomorrow, if I came up with the magic bullet, which we still do not have, but if I could cure it tomorrow, if I could come up with a vaccine that would protect everybody and I could cure the people that are infected, I'd still have to say, guess what, guys? Still use a condom. And do you want to know why? Can you guess why?
Hepatitis?
Not even. There are other infections. That's true. But the other thing I'm thinking is, you know, we in the 70s and in the early 80s, we got blindsided. No one ever suspected that there was a disease that would kill you that could be transmitted sexually. I mean, there are diseases that could possibly kill you. Syphilis kills people, but we can cure syphilis with penicillin. No one saw this coming. And had we used condoms to protect ourselves from these other diseases that we didn't care about getting, like hepatitis and gonorrhea and syphilis, we would not have gotten infected with HIV. And who knows what other crap's in the pipeline. I'm not about to take the chance, even if I cured HIV and eradicated it tomorrow, there isn't some other equally pesky little virus out there waiting. So safe sex is here for the duration.
But wait, doesn't that go back to your notion of acceptable risk? I mean, if we were to somehow cure HIV, mm-hmm. I mean, the notion of continuing to do this thing, which apparently a good percent of the population doesn't enjoy doing, just on the off chance that one day there might be another disease for which this is the best prevention, I mean, that doesn't seem to fall into most people's notion of acceptable risk, you know?
Right, but that's my level of acceptable risk at this point, and I guess it's because I've seen too much stuff.
Okay, well, thanks for hearing me out.
Sure, thanks for calling.
All right, thanks.
I'm actually haunted by the opposite scenario. What if we discover that there's a disease caused by safe sex?
Oh dear.
I'm serious.
Boredom?
You know, a condom induced, you know, gay cancer.
What about latex allergies?
Mm-hmm.
And also, exactly. You've got a rash on your male member.
Mm-hmm. Someplace else.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. My male member. Well, all right. Well, certainly plenty to think about. So,
Before we leave this topic, I think caller does have a good point. And Bill, I was wondering if you might say a few words about the CARP program.
I would if I could tell you a whole lot about it. Mm-hmm. The Community AIDS Risk Reduction Program was instigated to talk about why people don't do safe sex. Mm-hmm. Was basically the reason. And what they did was the behavioral things, and they looked particularly, I think, at the use of drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that if I'm getting this right, and gosh, I just went through an in-service over this a couple of weeks ago, and I really am blanking on a lot of it, but I think what they really found was that a prevention seminar or series of seminars, a prevention technique going out to people works better if not only talking about safe sex, you address issues of alcohol use and drug use and how that kind of thing plays into perhaps not being safe all the time. And so I think they found that if you have that kind of a focus, where you're not just talking about the safe sex stuff, you're talking about the kind of things that make you vulnerable, that it makes the message clearer and easier to follow and more cogent for people.
Do you have any of these numbers at your fingertips? I mean, of people who are infected, you know, what percentage of them are people who are really on the wagon when they're sober and sort of playing it safe, and then, you know, one night they're on a bender and trouble occurs?
I would say we did a study back in the late 80s of people who had seroconverted. Seroconversion refers to the blood converting from being free of virus to being infected with virus. Okay, so we looked at 40 people who had seroconverted, and we talked to them about how this happened. And what we found out was that 32, I believe it was, out of the 40. Well, let me back up. Let's do it this way. Two out of the 40, it happened because of mental health issues. One was just plain suicidal and crazy. The other was depressed. Okay, and those are things that can feed into you doing stuff that you normally wouldn't do. To answer your question about alcohol and drugs, there were six of them, I believe, that was really their risk factor. They either lost their inhibitions or they were completely blacked out and things were done to them without their permission. But what's interesting is the vast majority, 32 out of the 40, gambled.
Okay.
We called it gambling. And what they did was they said, oh, this is the love of my life. I'm feeling romantic tonight. I don't want to talk about this. I'll let this happen. Even though I know better on an intellectual level, I'm going to do this anyway because of my need for intimacy or my need for romance or my inability to bring this topic up or whatever. And 32 out of the 40, that's how they got infected.
This actually inspires me a related question. I mean, do you have any sense of I mean, it seems in some sense that people like that have all kinds of sex, you know, the people who engage in sex as sport, in some sense, you could argue they tend to be more responsible than, you know, like people who go to the bathhouses or people who go to sex clubs. I mean, it seems like there's actually some more rigid rules there than people who are having, you know, sex in you know, with someone that they've just met at a bar. I mean, can you classify, like, am I making sense?
Well, I mean, you're making sense in that, you know, there's more sort of formal acknowledgement that the behavior is going to be sexual. You can't be fooling yourself about whether you're there for a sexual reason when you're at a sex club. It's right. At least harder to do.
You usually don't go to a sex club for the coffee,
right? Or romance,
yes.
All right.
But just because it's more structured and people know that they're going there for sex, basically, does not mean that the activity is safer or that people play safe. By any means. Okay. You know, most places say if you do something unsafe, you're out, or if there's anal sex, you're out. But very rarely, at least the places I go, there are no monitors. They're not walking around. It's just that if one of the people who work there happens to see something, they'll probably kick you out. But there's no strict enforcement of these rules. Yeah. It's, you know, two consenting adults, what they do behind a closed door.
I mean, it seems like there would be some value in that. I want to start some kind of, like, safe sex Pittsburgh dungeon where, you know, anything goes.
Well, you have this monitoring problem.
Be converted into that.
You have this problem of monitoring. Privacy versus this monitoring. If you're going to guarantee this, you're going to have to monitor.
Well, I'd have to have my little safe sex trolls. I mean, we can get off this topic.
People do not want other people poking their heads in while they are having sex.
Well, yeah, I will say, we were talking earlier about this club in San Francisco that is a safe sex club, and they're pretty big on the fact that it has to be safe. And I think what they've accomplished is pretty good because there's very little privacy.
And yes.
And there are people who actually do work there and wander about. And they promote an atmosphere where, you know, you have to be safe there. I'm not saying things don't happen there, but it's highly unlikely compared to other bathhouses which aren't as strictly monitored. So it can work. And I didn't find it inhibiting sexually.
I did. Well, then again, that is the difference between sex clubs and bathhouses. In North America, bathhouses usually have closed doors,
right?
You know, with the door you can lock on it, and no one can see in, and so you can't guarantee that unsafe sex will not happen.
Right. So what Corey's talking about is more like the club thing that I was describing earlier, as opposed to a bathhouse.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
That would have to be.
By referring to me as Corey, you refer to my safe sex code name that I use in the bathhouses. Here in the studio, I'm DJ.
You're DJ.
DJ Safe Sex 5000.
Is there a shortened version of that?
You may refer to me as
Sir.
Master.
Sorry, oh, master.
Sir.
Well, sir.
I think a change of topic might be in order. So what are some of the reasons that people give for not practicing safe sex?
Well, the lack of intimacy and the lack of romance is a big one. We touched on the condoms are bothersome, they don't fit, they don't feel right.
Our caller alluded to that too, this whole, like, the whole negotiation aspect and even the whole considering, you know, your lover as your infector, you know, does seem to reduce the romance level somewhat.
There's a certain amount of invulnerability that younger people tend to feel, I think, which does play into it. The same reason why they drive cars fast.
I keep hearing that, but isn't that like something Esther Tro would say? I mean, like, is that really true? That, like, do 19-year-olds really feel invulnerable?
Yeah. I think they do.
Yes, I think they do too.
I felt pretty invulnerable when I was 19.
Yeah. Well, what about this feeling of inevitability?
WRCT does not specifically condone or condemn Esther Tro.
What about
inevitability?
Inevitability. Yeah, yes. I have had people tell me in the course of my work that they just didn't do it, safe sex, that is, the way they should do it, because they kind of felt that they were going to get infected anyway. So they might as well just forget about it. Mm-hmm. So it gets into, and I think that gets into the psychological issues, self-esteem issues, and that I think is a major component in this.
And do people now tend to consider it a manageable illness now with all these, like?
Well, yes. We have these new drugs, which these protease inhibitor cocktails, which in most people cause their viral load or burden in their blood, the amount of virus that you find in their blood, to drop to what's called undetectable levels. Well, undetectable does not mean non-existent. It means below the threshold. Like, you know, we can only hear within a certain range of hertz, okay? And anything that falls below or above that is things that we can't hear because our ears can't pick it up. So it doesn't mean the sound isn't there. It just means that our ears can't pick it up. Well, it's the same thing with this test. It can only go down to a certain level. And if the viral level is below that threshold, it can't be detected. Doesn't mean it ain't there. It means it can't be detected.
Right. And so is that indeed true? Do people, when they stop taking these drugs, does their load begin to increase?
Yes,
again?
It does.
Okay.
It does. And I think there are some people who look at it as a cure. It's not a cure. It's a maintenance to keep the virus relatively inactive in your system. They look at it as something that, oh, well, if someone's taking it and their viral level is undetectable, that means they can't infect me. And that's not true, as I just pointed out. And I think that sometimes it makes people a little less concerned. Or they might say, well, geez, if I get infected, so what? I can take drugs. But they have to think about is the fact that these drugs are incredibly expensive. And the fact that they have terrible side effects sometimes. It's not pleasant taking these drugs. I mean, I know some people who take them and they have absolutely no side effects and they feel great. Most people I know complain of some sort of side effect, which go from the mildly annoying to being very ill. And some people have to go off the therapy because the side effects are so strong.
Are we still concerned that the virus might mutate around these drugs and become resistant? That we might see strains of
that's always going to be a fear. The thing is that if you take the drugs and you take them as directed, and you're not one of those minority of people who the drugs won't help for some reason, and you really take them where you're supposed to, if you keep the viral level of activity so low that the amount of virus found in the blood's undetectable, so it's really low, instead of it being in the hundreds of thousands, it's in a couple of hundreds, the possibility of viral mutation has gone way down because the virus is not replicating as rapidly. You're going to get mutation more as it's rapidly reproducing itself. So yeah, if you follow all the rules, the inevitability of this happening is going to be really small, but you can't say it's impossible.
So I have a question. Let's say, you know, my lifelong dream has always been to be the biggest slut in Pittsburgh. Okay. Now, is it possible for me to achieve this goal and still be a responsible citizen? Like, can I just follow these simple guidelines of, you know, always use, if I say always use condoms during anal sex with strangers, don't let men ejaculate in my mouth. Can I just be like, you know, the queen of the truck stop? Or, you know, what am I missing? It seems to me there's only a couple of rules and I can just go nuts. Or
I think in the most basic sense, you have a pretty good point, but you can't say you've eliminated your risk.
Right. I mean, is promiscuity also? I mean, some people would say, well, if you shouldn't be promiscuous if you want to be safe.
I can go out and have safe sex with a couple of dozen, a couple of hundred people, and that would be a lot safer than me having unsafe sex with one partner. Because if that one partner that I happen to choose to be unsafe with is infected, I will become infected if I'm not being safe. And I can go out and have all the fun I want with half the city of Pittsburgh, and as long as I'm being safe, my risk factor is very small in comparison.
Can we go back to your first statement? So, I mean, how many actual sex acts does it take? Is it really an issue of exactly one, or is it a few?
It can be just one.
Can be
sure.
Just one.
Absolutely. I'm not saying that if I go out and do the promiscuity thing that I can't slip up and something can happen, certainly. But
early on in the epidemic, I mean, I remember people saying that there was this quantity issue, like you had to have sex with a lot of men before, you know, you got enough little viral injections, so to speak, for you to become infected. And I believe that's not true, right? I mean,
one
encounter with an infected partner is enough.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It just takes once. We have people who have been a number of different times exposed to the virus, and it just for some reason didn't take. And yet we have some people, we have a number of people who are exposed just once and it took.
And they can actually point out the specific act,
yes,
the specific day when they when they got it?
It's pretty easy when you're dealing with someone who has been pretty much been being like very Mr. Safe for years, and they make that one choice, and that's the choice that infects them. It's pretty easy to pinpoint it right at that point. Mm-hmm. And that does happen.
So in general, we're talking about that a choice to have unprotected anal intercourse.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yes.
So have you ever had, in your experience, Typhoid Mary kind of persona, someone who was acting deliberately unsafe despite
knowing that they were positive?
Well, either knowing that they're positive or just acting safe despite knowing better, just in general.
Like that guy up in New York State, Western New York State, who
infected. Well, so he knew he was positive and was infecting other people, but
yeah,
I can imagine even just inducing young people to have unsafe sex with you could also. I mean, that doesn't.
Yes,
yeah, inappropriate either.
Has there any been reported evidence of such things?
I have quite a number of younger friends, and I like young people, and they like me, and that's great, and I enjoy that. But some of them brought to me stories about a fellow, probably in his 40s, who was also attracted to young people, and was saying things like, "Oh, you know, we don't really need to use a condom when I insert my penis into your rectum because I go to the Pitt Men study and they, you know, I always test negative." And I did write a letter to OUT about that, not outing the person who was doing it, but referring to that scenario and warning people that, you know, that is nothing. You should not go on someone's word. If they say they come to the Pitt Men study, well, maybe they do, maybe they don't, and maybe they are positive, maybe they are negative, and they can tell you anything.
But so even if you take them at their word that they've certainly been negative, maybe they have been negative all the times they've been tested recently, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But that's, is it still considered to be a six-month window between...
There's a window up to 6 months, yes, between the point of infection and the test showing antibodies. I could have been infected 2 weeks ago and had a test done today, and it would show up negative.
Do you think that if... I've sort of wondered about this. Do you think if there were some sort of, skin prick test or saliva test where you could test your partner immediately before having sex with them and get a result immediately, like, you know?
Well, it couldn't be an antibody test because
I'm just saying that in my fantasy Star Trek world,
right.
Do you think that would actually change people's behaviors? Because if you could instantly test your partner, do you think people would, or do you still think that there are other barriers to, if you wore special glasses and they appeared blue, you know, if they were...
Well, does this bring up the intimacy issue that was raised by our caller?
I mean, if you're having trouble, you know, putting on a thin piece of latex, consider, you know, having to tell this person, oh, I'm sorry, you know,
right.
You're infected with a fatal disease.
Right. Well, if it were some sort of subdermal implant that would just notify you telepathically, I suppose then...
So you don't have to think about it. You just know.
By the way, if you're not calling because you don't know the phone number, it's 268-WRCT, 621-WRCT. Please call. Okay, so that was my little science fiction question, and we settled that. Are there any plausible reasons not to have safe sex? Like, I've heard this argument, for example, oh, we both are HIV positive, so we can just go to town.
Oh, I'm glad am I that you brought that up. They call it, I think, riding bareback or barebacking or something like
mm-hmm.
that.
And loading the warp core.
It's something along those lines. And the theory being that, well, if I'm positive and you're positive, we're both infected, and therefore, why do we care? Well, we should care for a couple different reasons, and that is, first of all, as we alluded earlier, there are other diseases.
Right.
And if I were HIV positive and I had never had hepatitis or never had CMV infection or never had picked up herpes, I would darn well want to not pick those up now because I might have an impaired immune system and those diseases could be even worse for me. The other thing is that, let's go back to this bit about viral replication and getting mutations. Let's say I'm I get a relatively naive form of the virus, a form of the virus that's very susceptible to any number of drugs that we have. And I have sex with someone who's been trying every drug on the face of the earth and building resistance to them. And I get myself reinfected with his virus. That means when I go to choose a drug, I've automatically limited the drugs I can choose because I now have his mutated forms of the virus. And that's not good. Because if I'd have just kept the original form I had originally, then I could take any number of drugs and keep it under wraps.
So let's switch to another scenario. What about two people who say, well, we've both tested negative and we've both agreed to be monogamous. Do you count that as safe? How?
Again, anytime two people exchange body fluids, it's not safe. There is a degree of risk, and that degree of risk is that monogamous relationships mean, first of all, mean different things to different people, and people lie. People fall off the wagon of monogamy and, you know, talk about, oh, honey, we're going to have sex tonight, and by the way, when I was in Denver last month, guess what? So we're going to have to use a condom. That's not going to get talked about in a lot of relationships. I mean, in theory, if two people had been tested over and over again and were truly monogamous and they both were HIV negative and they exchanged fluids, the likelihood of them giving each other HIV is very, very small, obviously. But now you're getting into dynamics of relationships and human behavior. And we all know, I mean, if people were truly monogamous, there wouldn't be so many divorces now, would there?
That's a sobering thought.
So my question is, you know, so what's the answer? Just save sex, grit your teeth, do it from now on. Is there no good way? Well, I think that's what we're kind of asking ourselves.
Well, if I can recast that question, you know, we've been very individually prescriptive, right? You know, put on a condom, use it. But what sort of public policy things can we do to make sure that people actually do this?
Public
is there anything
policy.
any sort of public policy thing we can do, or what I mean?
We can promote communication between people, and I think the biggest barrier to this epidemic getting smacked down any faster than it can be is that people just don't want to talk about it. And it goes back to what the caller was talking about for various reasons, embarrassment or intimacy issues. People put walls up, and instead of bringing the walls down and saying, okay, this is uncomfortable, but you know what, we have to talk about this and we have to work around this.
Well, it's not just, I mean, there's also not just people, but, you know, the society in general is not comfortable with the idea of, I mean, if every episode of Blossom dealt with, putting on a condom before anal intercourse, I think it would be much more in people's.
But I think it's even worse than that, because there are groups in the society that actually actively prevent such information from being spread, because they don't want other people to hear about this.
Oh, absolutely.
And that just disgusts me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know who we're talking about.
Yes,
there.
We do.
We have a great problem with certain religious groups and certain other kinds of groups that, for instance, say that we can't talk to our kids about sex because we're going to give them ideas. Well, you know what? I remember having sexual ideas when I was 4, and no one ever talked to me about sex.
Well, slow down. I mean, you were clearly not raised in a family with high morals.
Be that as it may,
right, I mean, let's confuse cause and effect here. I mean, maybe a little.
No one talked to me about sex when I was 4 years old, but darn, I kind of knew what it was intuitively. And putting ideas in people's minds is completely off base. What you have to do is you have to acknowledge that children are sexual beings the same way as adults are sexual beings. Well, maybe not the same way, but we're both sexual beings as adults and as children, and we have to address that issue, and we have to let them know, you know, that's cool. Sex is part of being a human being. And here are some of the rules about sex. And this is what happens to you if you don't follow the rules, whether that's pregnancy or or HIV infection or what. And we don't encourage that in this country. And I'm glad we have programs like this where we can talk openly about sexual issues.
Yes, absolutely. But I don't want to get into this debate because, you know, the people on the other side would say, well, you know, what you need is abstinence and family values. But really, I mean, everybody, I mean, you know, the objectivist would say you need to assign a monetary value to the sexual transaction, and it would be too expensive until, you know, I mean, so every group, I think, has its own solution to this problem. And I mean, I'm sure the religious groups that you refer to would say, well, of course, you know, if you're just abstinent until you get married, then there is no problem. So, I mean, we don't agree with that. I personally don't agree with that, since my goal is, in fact, to be the biggest slut in Western Pennsylvania. I'm just saying there is a reason for this debate, and it's because hope other people feel strongly. I think quite wrongly and quite dangerously wrongly, but they do feel strongly that they have an approach that works. I mean, anyway. But we don't want to get into this debate because it's not that interesting.
And we have to wrap. Before we have to wrap up this thing, I do just want to say again, from deep down in my heart, that if you're out there having sex, please, if for no one's sake other than mine, which is not much of an inducement, but please be safe. Be safe every time you have sex. I really am very tired of people coming crying to me. That doesn't mean you can't come crying to me. Please do. That's my job. But it would be so nice if I didn't have to deal with that situation anymore. I've seen enough illness. I've seen enough death. I've seen enough heartbreak. And it's so preventable. Yeah, it's hard to do, but so are taxes.
Taxes are tough.
Taxes are tough.
Every year. Oh. Every paycheck they hurt.
And they're so confusing.
That's right, and it's just getting more confusing.
Absolutely. But yeah, please play a lot, have fun, but be safe about it.
So, and you, Bill, indeed, you deal with the aftermath of people's decisions every day.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you're alluding to, and you probably see people make the same kind of mistakes and see the same kind of regrets.
And I see incredibly intelligent, motivated, gifted people screw up. And it's not just people who like don't give a you know what about their existence. I mean, these are people who have a lot to lose, and they slip up, and that's human nature. This is never going to go away. People are going to slip up, but we have, that just means we have to be that much more vigilant. We have to really resolve that this is what needs to be done if we wish to live long and healthy lives and have, you know, nurture our community and all that kind of thing. So you really have to bite the bullet and deal with it. And whatever that takes, if it takes therapy or a group or the support of friends or whatever, you know, you've got to recognize whatever that is you need, and you have to actively go out and do it.
So, Bill, when is this all going to be over?
When is this all going to be over? I wish I could tell you. I think, sir, you and I will be in the nursing home grabbing the cute young attendants and still dealing with it.
Biting the orderlies.
Mm-hmm. I intend to be there.
Really? So you don't see any sort of... I mean, it would be nice, you know, if medical technology progressed as fast as, you know, computer technology did in, you know, in a year and a half.
Oh, don't bring up computer technology, because it's going to come crashing down in 2 years, you know.
this is the year 2000 problem?
But yeah, it would be nice, but I don't see it coming in the near future.
Year 2000?
The HIV being eradicated issue, I really think we've made some incredible progress. We have taken a viral illness and learned so much about it in such a short period of time in a field of virology and in immunology, which are infant fields. We've done some amazing things, but it's such a complex problem, we can't stop it tomorrow.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us. That was a fabulous time. Sebastian, thank you for taking time out of your busy bathhouse schedule.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Thanks for joining us. This is WRCT Pittsburgh. It's midnight. Thank you for listening, and good night.